Hey, welcome everybody. This is the State of the CIO, where we talk with America's top IT leaders about the changing role of technology in the C-suite. I'm your host, Dan Kelly. Hey everybody, Dan Kelly here with State of the CIO podcast. I hope everyone is having a great day today. Today we've got an outstanding guest once again. His name is Dr. Eric Cole, goes by Eric. Eric is a distinguished cybersecurity expert and a keynote speaker. He's helped organizations both in public and private sector, ranging from Fortune 500 companies to top international banks to the CIA. He's a featured speaker at many security events and has been interviewed by several media outlets such as CNN, CBS, Fox News, and 60 Minutes. Hi, Eric. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me, Dan.
Of course. Of course. I gave a high-level introduction, but I know our audience would love a brief introduction by yourself. And in that introduction, if you could please tell me kind of how you got into this space to begin with, specifically IT and then cybersecurity. Was it something you always wanted to do as a kid, or did you fall into it? So I'll let you just start with the introduction.
Absolutely. So as a kid growing up, I always wanted to be an architect. I'm still fascinated when you look at bridges and buildings of how these are actually built and sustained with winds and snow and everything else. But when I was 16, a friend of the family said, Eric, now remember, this was back in the 80s. He goes, Eric, everything's moving to computers. So why don't you major in computer science? And then with computer science, you can do anything you want. You can be an architect, you can be an accountant, but having those core computer skills would work. And I said, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So I majored in computer science and I'm in my second semester. And back in the 80s, it was more like engineering. So I'm sitting there going, is this what I really want to do? So I go down to the co-op office and they go, Eric, tomorrow the CIA is recruiting. Why don't you interview with the CIA? So I go through that process. I get accepted to the CIA. And now I get to go to all the offices and decide where I want to work. And there's a networking office, an operating system office, a programming office. And there's this little office called cybersecurity. And I go back and I talk to my advisors and they're like, Eric, everything's networking. Go for networking. Go for networking. That's the key. And I'll sometimes listen and sometimes I don't. And this time I didn't listen. And I said, no, that cybersecurity sounds really cool. And my advisor said, Eric, cybersecurity is going to be solved in 2 to 3 years. It's a fad. Nobody's going to be doing cybersecurity in 20 years. You shouldn't have made that decision. We can see that sometimes people are wrong. So I go into the security division and I essentially ask a question of how do we know these systems are secure? And there's no way of knowing. So I basically launched on an 8-year career of being a professional hacker. So for 8 years, I hacked anything with a computer, anything on the planet. I was able to hack and break in. And I'll be honest with you, after 8 years, I got bored because you could always get in. It's too easy. So I decided to do two things. One, to leave the agency because I love the government. I think everyone should serve the government at some point, but I'm an entrepreneur at heart. I like building, growing companies. So I left and I started my own company. And then I also decided to focus on the defense because that's where people really need help. Offense, you only have to find one way in. Defense, you have to find it all. So I really help companies build out that strategy. So I built a company called TSGI. We sold it to Lockheed Martin. And then Bob Stevens, the CEO and president at the time, kept me on as his chief scientist that I did for 6 years. So anytime Lockheed had any security problems, I got the phone call at 2 a.m., jumping on a private jet and flying out to wherever it is, solving that. Then I went to McAfee and helped them redesign their software suite. And we ended up selling that company to Intel. So I had two nice acquisitions in there. And then I had this crazy idea that why don't I do my own company? So now I'm running Secure Anchor and building that up to really help organizations implement effective security that really works. Because to me, you look at all these companies that have major breaches and they all have the same thing in common. They all spent a lot of money on security. They all have security people on their staff and they all did the wrong thing. So a lot of companies are doing good things when it comes to security, not the right thing. So we help companies build out an effective security roadmap that actually protects and secures their critical assets.
It sounds like you might be a guy that gets bored easily.
Yes. You think you sensed a little bit of that?
We may be similar there. Yeah. Hence how we both left our government service. So that makes perfect sense. Tell me a little bit about what are the biggest risks for a Fortune 500 company today, knowing our primary listenership are the IT leadership in those type of companies. You know, what are you seeing as the biggest risks today? Some may be apparent, which is fine. Some may not be. Could you just speak to that maybe a little bit of a state of the union from a landscape perspective?
So I'll start very high level and then I'll jump a level down. So to me, the biggest risks that any company has, no matter the size, is they don't think they're a target. Everybody views cybersecurity like they do accidents and illnesses. Those are things that happen to other people. So I go into small, medium, large size companies and number one, Eric, we don't have to worry about cybersecurity. Nobody would target us. Nobody would come after us. And I will show you, I'm very big on letting data drive decisions, not emotions. I will show you the data. You are being targeted. You are absolutely being compromised. And then the other problem is they don't think cybersecurity is their responsibility. And then I'll give the next example. I was recently 2 weeks ago talking with an executive. It was about a $2 billion company. And he goes, Eric, we don't need any help with cybersecurity because we haven't had any breaches in the last 2 years. And that sort of makes sense. You haven't had a breach, you don't need help. The problem is he absolutely needed help. And here's why. If you haven't detected an attack in 2 years, it's because you haven't looked in the right spot. It's not because it's not happening. I will tell you right now, if you honestly believe that every other company on the planet is being attacked and you're not, it either means that you have magical unicorn grade security, which you don't have, or you're not looking in the right spot. So I often joke the indicator of good security means you're detecting breaches. The indicator of bad security means you haven't had any breaches because it's not that it's not happening. You're missing the big picture. And then in terms of the biggest exposure, it's actually real simple. You take every one of the major data breaches over the last 3 years, and every single one of them had a server accessible from the internet they weren't aware of. It wasn't up to date with patches and it contained critical data that wasn't properly encrypted. So if you want to go in as a CIO or a strategic thinker in your organization and you want to do the best service when it comes to cybersecurity, make sure you have a network visibility map, know all of your assets visible from the internet, make sure they're fully patched and make sure they don't contain any critical data. If companies just did that, if all they did was knew their assets, patched them and didn't put critical data, I will tell you right now, every one of the major breaches you've read about in the news would not have happened.
That's really good insight. And I keep reminding myself, you know, sometimes the most simple solution is the best solution, such as just this password resets concept. But I'm wondering, with the introduction of all these new endpoints, because people are working from home, if you've seen that change the landscape at all, because I know our listeners are very interested in that. And if you've seen anything change from that perspective, what do you suggest they do about it?
Yeah, huge change with the working from home and the epidemic. The way I look at it is I'll go to any company and I say, okay, how many new offices did your company open up in 2020? And they're like, Eric, we shut down offices. We didn't open up any new offices. I said, wrong. I said, how many employees do you have? And they go, 7,000. I'm like, you opened up 7,000 new offices this year. You might not have realized it, but that's essentially what COVID did. It made everybody's home a remote office, which then put the organization at risk. So there's short-term and there's long-term. Short-term fixes is that endpoint that you're doing corporate work on and that you're accessing critical data. That's a huge target of phishing, drive-by downloads, and other web-based attacks. The thing we have to remember when we're talking about endpoints or clients, the two most dangerous applications on planet Earth are email clients and web browsers. They are pretty much the source of all evil. So the problem is this. I'm using my computer that contains critical data at work or personal financial data, and then I'm also checking email and surfing the web. One click, one mistake, which I can guarantee everyone's going to make, could put all that information at risk. All that data at risk, ransomware, many other factors. So the short-term solution that I tell everyone is have a Windows computer as your primary work computer. This is where you write reports, you do your analysis, you do all that. Then have a non-Windows-based computer, an iPad or an iPhone or an Android that you use for surfing the web and checking email. And the reason is simple. Almost all of the malware we've seen in 2020 is all for Windows. So if you're running a non-Windows-based system, the probability of getting impacted is low. Second, I do all my email and web surfing on my iPhone. Now there's no data on here. So even if I make a mistake, and even if I click on a link and this gets infected, which the probability is low, my data is still safe and still protected. So the short-term solution is we have to train people to use two different computers, one for work, one for email and web surfing, and those two need to be separated. Otherwise, when you put them together, the risk is too high. Longer-term solution is I believe the architect of the future is going to be everything in the cloud with a robust authentication layer. Let's face it, passwords are not a good option today. We need to move to two-factor, certificate-based, location-based authentication. The technology is out there. We need to start using it. So we need to start moving everything to the cloud with an authentication layer. Then on the endpoint, the long-term solution is thin clients. We really have to move to a thin client. The two benefits of thin clients, one, you get a new operating system every day. So now patching is not an issue because you just patch the central system. And now if I make a mistake at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and I click on a link or open an attachment, which everybody does, and I get infected, I'm infected for 2 hours, not 2 years. So we're now containing and controlling. So every day you get a brand new operating system. It's in place. It's protected. And none of the data is on your local system. It's crazy to think that we're letting people have 4 terabytes of storage at their home. I mean, that's nuts. That's a lot of corporate data that we're not controlling. So to me, that long-term solution is thin clients at the remote office and then cloud-based with robust authentication. Because the solution that anybody in IT or security really needs to recognize is it has to be location agnostic. We are not going back to anything normal anytime soon. So any solution we design has to be location agnostic. No matter where you're located, no matter where you're at, you have the same level of protection, security, and services. And unfortunately, prior to 2020, most IT environments weren't designed that way.
It's really fascinating insight. That question came to my mind as you were speaking there. Are you seeing corporations provide security software to employees, not only for their work devices, but I mean, let's face it, I think the work device, quite frankly, is actually going away. As much as in a perfect world, we would actually create two separate environments like you're discussing, you know, for work and play, if you will. You know, the bring your own device is largely here for the mobile device, clearly, but also I think it's coming for the laptop, et cetera. So I'm wondering, are you seeing companies provide security software for their employees to use on personal devices as well? And if not, do you think that's a good idea?
So some of my clients that I call early adopters, I started seeing that, but I'll be honest with you. Most of the clients we work with, March, April timeframe, depending on where in the world you are, because COVID hit at different times, pretty much it was survivability. One day, everybody left the office and the next day they never returned. So most companies, it was all about use what you have. Let's get VPNs. Let's get remote access. Let's go all of that. And nobody thought about security. And now as the breaches are increasing and the exposures are increasing, now they're starting to step back saying, okay, maybe we should be buying a license for endpoint security. Maybe we should be putting more measures in place. But a very interesting data point is back in January of 2020, my primary breakdown of my work with clients, 70% was proactive security assessments. This was companies that said, Eric, we know we're at risk. We want to fix the problem before we have a major breach, and we want you to help us. And 30% was incident response expert witness, where they didn't do proactive, they got a breach and they needed help. May, June, July has been rough on security assessments because nobody's spending money on security. Nobody's spending money on anything. I just looked at our numbers for August, September, October, and it switched. 20% was security assessments proactive and 80% was reactive, which means companies ignored security for 6 months. And now we're starting to see major breaches. So if you're listening to this, you really have two choices. One is wait for the breach, which will happen in the next couple of months. It probably happened. You just didn't realize it. Or really start getting aggressive with protecting the endpoint and authentication with security, because the probability of a compromise over the last 6 months when you were focused on survivability is almost a guarantee.
I just was thinking about, you know, this podcast, if you took out the IT component, it could almost sound like we're selling insurance.
Exactly. That's true. Yeah.
Wait to get a tag, wait for your house to burn down or be proactive. That's fascinating. And, you know, I'm curious, I am personally fascinated with the concept of doing a penetration test. I am not a doer. I've never been able to do it myself, but I know a lot about the process, not as much as you, clearly, but based on our backgrounds. Would you suggest that every company put themselves through a pen test? And if so, at what level? Maybe just speak to that a little bit. And maybe actually, before you even get into that, explain what a penetration test is for our listeners and then talk about the benefits of the same.
Okay. So I'll just warn you, you might not like my answer, but I'll answer. So a penetration test is sometimes called ethical hacking. It's where you're trying to break into an organization from an attacker standpoint. So when we do a pen test for a client, they're going to give us a domain name or a business card or just some general representation of the company. We're going to take just that and then we're going to simulate a full scale attack. We're going to see what we can find out, how we can get in, how we can compromise, how we can break in to the organization and be able to compromise it. I honestly, and there's a lot of security folks that don't like me, but I always give reasons. So you can look at my reasons and say, is it good or not? I actually don't recommend penetration tests for a couple of reasons. First, most pen testers are focused on, can we get in? So a lot of my friends that do pen testing for a living, they're like, Eric, I'm doing a pen test right now. I haven't found the smoking gun. I need to find a smoking gun. I need to find a big way in. So let's say they find three ways in. They're happy. They found three ways to exploit your organization, but there's 20, but they only present three to you. So the problem with a pen test, it's not comprehensive. It's only giving you a partial view of some exposure points, which might or might not be actual vectors into your organization, because every pen tester has their own special tricks. So they're going to use those, but that might not be representative of a real attack. Second, when you're getting in to specialized environments, hospitals, utility companies, anything that has non-Windows Unix-based systems, pen tests are extremely dangerous. Because if you go in and you don't understand or know how those devices act and function, you can inadvertently knock them down, do denial of service attacks, do other major compromises or impacts. I know for a fact that a few of the outages we had in this country where certain parts of the country lost electricity, it was because of a pen test gone bad. Now, they didn't publicly do that because that would be bad. So they had to go, it was a natural occurrence or some other BS that they come up with. But I can tell you for a fact with one of those, that's exactly what happened. And the third reason is today, one of the big things that we push with our clients is offensive countermeasures. The idea of offensive countermeasures is let's set up decoys to make it hard for the attacker to break in. If I have four servers visible from the internet, I want it to look like 50. If I have five ports, I want to look like 20. So if I'm now creating all these offensive countermeasures that make it very hard and difficult to break in, what am I also doing for the pen tester? I'm making it really difficult. It's now going to take them five times as long to get in, and they're not going to be as beneficial. So what do pen testers do? They go to the company, and I hear this all the time. Listen, Dan, we're going to be able to break it. We're going to be able to get around your defense. So instead of wasting 30 hours of us getting in, why don't you just give us an account, give us a system, and then they convince you, they essentially social engineer you, right?
Exactly. That's
social. To go in. So they're pen testing you already. And now you give them accounts and access, and it defeats the whole purpose.
They already got in because they're talking to you in the first place.
Exactly. So I am not a fan of pen testing, but here's what I'm a fan of.
That's good feedback.
Is doing threat mapping. And this is what you do. Sit down with your team with a big whiteboard or a big piece of paper, and you have the threats on the left-hand side, the vulnerabilities in the middle, and your assets on the right. And then you actually go in and say, how would an attacker break it? And now you're doing a comprehensive breakdown. It's not going to have a negative impact. You won't get stopped by offensive countermeasures, and this gives you better visibility. The other option that I prefer is have a full-blown security assessment. Why run the risk? Let me come in. Let us look at your organization and let us evaluate everything. This is more equivalent to a physical you would get with a doctor. The way I would compare a pen test is you go to a doctor and the doctor looks at you and says, okay, it looks like you have cholesterol issues. It looks like, and they're assessing you just externally. They're not doing any blood work test or anything else. Do a full security assessment. They're not much more money. Typically, a pen test is going to run you 30 or 40K, and a full assessment is going to run you 50 or 60K. Trust me, you're going to get five times the value. So I would recommend to organizations stay away from pen testing and focus more on threat mapping or security assessments for the reasons I just stated.
As you were describing this, I had the question in my mind, how often would Eric suggest someone do this? And if you're relating it to a physical, is it annually or is it more often, less often?
So minimal of once a year, unless you have major changes that occur. So if you acquire a new company, if you change out an entire business unit, if you strategically reorganize your entire IT infrastructure, then you would need to have it more often. But otherwise, once a year is a good way just to understand what's happening and what's occurring.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I was thinking as well about international versus North American risk. I know you work and obviously have personal experience working internationally. I was wondering if you're seeing specific threats coming from specific nation states as they historically have, or are you seeing an increase in what I call, you know, this is not an official term, but kind of the gamer hackers, people that do it just as a hobby versus for an actual purpose. Are you seeing a change there as of late, or has it been consistent from a few years ago?
Yeah. So from an attacker standpoint, the big change we've seen is it's very very monetarily driven. It's really all about money. You see that a lot with ransomware. You see it stealing credit card data, personal data, anything that can be used to be sold on the dark web or get direct money. That's really the big drivers that are out there today. And we're seeing a lot more organized businesses. Like one of my favorite is RBN. RBN is the Russian Business Network. It is an incorporated Russian company. They have offices. They have three offices. They have employees. They come into the office. They have benefits. They have vacation, just like every other job, except their whole business model is stealing personal data and selling it on the dark web. And they average about $80 to $90 million of revenue a year doing it. So it's really becoming much more organized and structured in how it works and how it operates. And here's the big problem, and you probably know some of this working at the FBI, is we know who they are. I work with the FBI a lot. We know who they are. I can tell you their names, their addresses, their pictures, where they live. Problem is, in the countries they're coming from, it's not illegal and we don't have extradition treaties. So we know what they're doing, but unfortunately we can't stop them. And even if we block their IP address, they move so quickly. So CIOs need to recognize that, yes, I honestly believe in 12 to 15 years, this will be solved. We will have an international cybercrime unit for all governments and we'll work together and we'll be able to arrest and track this down a lot quicker. But at least for the foreseeable future, you're on your own. Law enforcement is amazing, but their hands are tied and there's only so much they can do because of the lack of international regulations that are in place.
Oh, and massive resource constraints.
Yeah.
Have to go after the biggest fish. Yeah, I've got two questions here. I can almost hear our listeners asking me questions in my head. You know, as an expert in your field, what keeps you up at night? And because I feel like the CISO position inside of large corporations is, I don't know, I would have a hard time sleeping at night knowing that I'd be responsible for the security of all this personally identifiable information. And if something goes wrong, you're almost doomed to be axed. So I'm just curious, Eric, what keeps you up at night as far as your understanding of the macroeconomic trends happening today?
I'm doing an assumption here because you're assuming I sleep.
You look like you do.
The few times I do sleep, I usually sleep very well, but hypothetically, I see where you're going. So the things that keep me up at night that worry me the most with organizations and clients is hardware embedded malicious code. It's the part we don't know about. So you look at it, we sit there, and if you ask most people, what's the biggest threat? What country represents the biggest threat? China is always going to be on the top three. It's China, Russia, Russia, China, China, Russia. So we're sitting there and saying that China launches massive cyber attacks against the United States. They're one of the biggest threats out there. Now pause for a moment. Take any electronics. Take your laptop, take your microphone, take your cell phone, take any of those devices and flip them over. What are the three magical words on the back? Made in China, right? So that's what bothers me because we've already seen cases where Cisco routers have come boxed up, shrink wrapped with malware on them. We've seen HP laptops. We've seen others. So my bigger concern is what if for the last 5 or 10 years, every memory chip or every CPU has embedded malware that just hasn't been activated, that it hasn't been turned on yet. Our solutions aren't architected yet. And this is where zero trust models come in, is where we have too much trust with those laptops for it to be able to be a big threat. Now, I know people are going to go, come on, Eric, if that really occurred and that really happened, wouldn't we know about it today? All I could say is Stuxnet. And Stuxnet was the PLC of the controller for an Iranian nuclear power plant. What most people don't realize, that malware was embedded in manufacturing and sat on that PLC for 11 years before it was activated. And I work in the nuclear space. Let me tell you, anything that's plugged to a critical digital asset, a CDA, the amount of scrutiny that that PLC went under before it went in production was significant. We're talking 9 to 12 months. Nobody saw it. Nobody caught it. And it sat there for 11 years. So if it can happen in a nuclear power plant, it can happen in our organizations. And that's what terrifies me the most, that things are a lot worse than we realize.
Roger that. Yep. I think that's really, really good insight. Our listeners are getting so much good information from this conversation. So thank you in advance. You mentioned a phrase. I want to make sure people understand that. And me personally, I'm just curious. The zero trust model. Can you talk about that a little bit as far as how people can implement that in their organizations?
Absolutely. So the general model that we've always used with security was called perimeter based, where you'd have a perimeter between the internet and your internal network. So the internal network was trusted and the outside network was untrusted. And then we even over the years expanded that with zones and VLANs. But even then within a VLAN, you have trust levels. So every computer within that is trusted. Well, the problem with that is if one of those computers get compromised or one of those computers get malware, then it will spread quickly within all those systems that are trusted. So this trust model minimizes but doesn't stop the problem or issue. So the idea of zero trust is we don't trust any computer. Every system is isolated. Every system is independent. Every system has its own controls in place. So now if one or two computers got compromised, one or two computers are compromised. It's not hundreds or thousands of computers. So it's really architecting your network. If you want to think of it from a IT CIO, is really you're putting every computer on a separate isolated VLAN. You're really doing micro segmentation, which is one of the newer areas in Cisco where you're segmenting out. And then you're even getting, if you want to really push zero trust, it's not even computer, but every piece of software on the system is now untrusted. So when you're looking at micro virtual machines where you're running different kernels and different memory space and everything is isolated, that's really the extremes of zero trust. So now even if one piece of software on one computer gets compromised, it's that one isolated segment of memory, nothing else on the computer and nothing else on the network would get impacted.
Thank you. That's very educational. I want to get to two of our standard questions on every episode, and I've not given you a heads up on these, so it'll be nice and raw conversation, just like we're having up to this point. That's nice and authentic. The first question is, you know, we have some younger listeners that listen to this show. They've given me feedback specifically how much they enjoy listening to the elders, if you will, but the people with experience essentially speak to them in a very authentic way about if they had to give themselves advice 20 years ago or so, what would that advice be? So maybe for someone that's starting out in your field, Eric, what advice would you give them to be the most successful within your specific field?
One of them is not technical, but I believe in it. It's something I started the last 6 or 7 years. I wish I started when I was 20. Read, read, read. To me, they're the brilliant people in the world, the Richard Bransons of the world, the Elon Musks. They share their knowledge in books. That's something that you can't get anywhere else. So I would recommend that you start a regimen of reading a book a week. That's an hour a night. Give up TV, give up Grand Theft Auto, give up any of that stuff. Read and fill your knowledge. That's going to give you a competitive advantage. Second big thing that I'm a firm believer on is bet on yourself, believe on yourself, and start your own consulting company. Why should you work for somebody else and you're earning them a dollar and they're giving you 20 cents and they're taking 80 cents of it? Bet on yourself. Earn a dollar. Now, I say earn a dollar, keep a dollar. Well, the government takes their amount. But the point is, you're now doing it. You would not believe how invigorating it was for me. Don't get me wrong. Government's important. But when I left the government and I actually was my own boss and I had my own freedom and I was working and the harder I worked, the more money I made. To me, it's just such an amazing experience. So I believe everybody should at some point in their life try and be an entrepreneur. Now, I think everyone loves it, but I know some don't. So you might do it for a year and hate it, but at least you gave it a shot and at least you bet on yourself. So stop undervaluing what you are in the market. Bet on yourself, start your own consulting company, do it for a year or two and then reevaluate.
Great advice. Yeah. And it's scary as shit when you leave a full-time job the first time. I mean, let's face it, right? I mean, you got mortgages, et cetera, but quite frankly, don't give up, right?
Yep.
The next question I want to ask you is a little off key, but I'm going to ask it anyway, because it's what was rated as the highest ranked question by our listeners starting this season's episode. Tell me your best worst boss story, which I know is an awkward combination of words, right? But, you know, one of the reasons that I think you were motivated to do your own thing as well is to just essentially you saw when things weren't going right or when your bosses were telling you to do something, you were like, this is stupid. I'm just curious. And it doesn't have to be necessarily a negative story, right? But tell me a time which really motivated you maybe to just go out and do your own thing where you're like, this is just stupid. And a lot of people have a lot of humorous stories here. So if you can think of anything, I know our listeners would appreciate it.
Okay, I'll share sort of what I consider my best or worst boss moment because it was life-changing for me and give a short example of what caused me to leave the government. So I was sitting in an all-hands meeting at the bubble. And if you've ever seen any Tom Clancy movies, that's the bubble shape at the CIA, right? It's very common. It's their big auditorium that seats thousands of people. And we're in that with an all-hands meeting. And this was in the 80s where they're talking about some of the new internet-based technologies that they're deploying. And I raised my hand. Because I had a question. And my boss in the front of the auditorium, just looks back for some reason, and she sees me with my hand up, and she's like, put your hand down. And so I thought she was waving. So I'm like, hey. And she's like, right? So, I kept my hand up there, and they finally, I guess, awkwardly call on me. And I ask a simple question that changed my entire life. I said, how do we know these systems are secure? Now, in the government, when you ask a question that nobody knows the answer to, you're volunteering to solve it. I didn't know that either. So they all look around and they're like, Eric, thank you for volunteering to solve that problem. And you see my boss, she's like, what have you done? Right? Because I was a good worker, and now she knew she lost me because now I'm on this special project. And essentially, it turned out that there was no way to prove a system was secure, only by breaking in. And that's what put me on the path of professional hacker for 8 years. So to me, that was one. Sometimes you got to be willing to take calculated risks. I'll be honest with you. I knew my boss wasn't waving at me. I knew what I was doing, but I'm like, nope. So it was a risk. It paid off, but it was one that was a little dangerous, but sort of crazy decisions. And you can probably relate to this, but I was called in my boss's office after I was at the agency for about 9 years. And she goes, Eric, I just need to talk to you. She goes, we just had the promotion panel and you didn't get promoted. And I'm like, what? I said, I do great. I come in early. She's like, Eric, it has nothing to do with how hard you work. We have people ahead of you that have to get promoted, time and grade. And
the most bullshit item, excuse my French, in the government, and it will always keep them down. And the only way they'll be successful is hiring consultants like us that don't like that. I'm sorry, Eric. I had to say that. Keep going. Time and grade.
So I look at it, I go, so let me ask you a question. What if I save the president's life? What if we're going to have a nuclear war and I'm able to hack into the computer systems and stop it from happening? She goes, Eric, in 6 years, we'll consider that for promotion. And at that point, I'm like, listen, I love you. You're an awesome boss, but I'm out of here, because I always believe you should get rewarded based on how hard you work, not on silly rules. And once again, nothing against some of those people, but some of those people that were ahead of me in promotion were some of the laziest people that didn't do anything to contribute. Now, some do great jobs, but others don't. And that was sort of my craziest story, going, you mean I'm not judged on the ability of how well I do? It's based on some weird criteria. So that was sort of one of my, okay, I'm checking out. And it sounds like you had similar frustrations.
Oh my God, you're right in my wheelhouse right now. I could talk for hours about it, literally.
And then I'll just add a crazy me being boss story. So 2 years ago, my marketing person calls me up and she's like, yeah, Eric, I think I'm leaving for another organization. I'm like, no, you're doing pretty good. How can we adjust? How can we adapt? She goes, Eric, you don't understand. I don't want to work for you anymore. And I said, but I thought I took care of you, everything else. She goes, Eric, you are the nicest, kindest, sweetest, most compassionate psychopath I've ever met, and I don't want to work for you. And I'm like, thank you. She goes, it's not a compliment. I said, yes, it is, right? So that's sort of my crazy. And that my employees always joke that I'm the nicest, kindest psychopath.
You got to be a little nuts, you know, to be
an entrepreneur. You got to be crazy. So that's why I took it as a compliment.
I fully get that. That's awesome. Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you. Eric, this has been an outstanding conversation. As we're kind of wrapping up here, any final thoughts you want to give our audience? And then I'll ask you to share your contact information so people can get a hold of you if they want to. But any final thoughts before we wrap it up for the day?
I would just say I've been doing this for 30 years. I am not one of those FUD guys that just make stuff up. I'm all about data. Let data drive decisions, not emotions. And I will tell you, cybersecurity is a real threat. It's probably one of the biggest threats to your organization. I know it's something you can't see and you can't understand, but it is real. Don't ignore the cybersecurity threat. Make sure you have an assessment. Make sure you understand what's happening in your organization. But if you go in and say, we haven't had a breach in 12 months, therefore we're secure, that's one of the most dangerous mentalities you can have. You are being compromised. You're just not catching it.
Roger that. And how can people get a hold of you, Eric? Are you on any of our social media platforms that are attacked every day?
Exactly. Yeah. I don't know how much of it is filtered or allowed. I give a lot of free content similar to you, Dan. I love helping people and making a difference. I'm on a mission to make cyberspace a safe place to live, work, and raise a family. So on social media, it's Dr. Eric Cole, DrEricCole. If you're interested, I do have a Life of a CISO show that I do on YouTube every week. And if you want to find out more about my company, or you just like to set up a consultation with me where I can just talk to you about your security needs, www.secure-anchor.com, secure-anchor.com. And it's on the website anyway, but if you want to contact me directly, it's ecole, E-C-O-L-E at secure-anchor.com. And I always love hearing from listeners.
I'm sure you'll have a lot of people reach out to you. Thank you very much, Dr. Cole. So you'd feel older now.
My pleasure, Dr. Dan. I'll call you Dr. Dan.
Great conversation. Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
If you enjoyed today's episode, feel free to hit subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts. And feel free to reach out to me directly to give me feedback and let me know how you like this episode. My email address is dan@thenegotiator.guru. Thanks so much, Eric. Talk to you soon. Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening. If you got value from today's conversation, please share this podcast with one person you think who would enjoy it. For show notes, episodes, and more, please visit thenegotiator.guru. Look forward to hearing from everyone soon. Thanks, and we'll talk to you soon.